Hello and welcome to LSTM's podcast series, where we meet some of the most curious minds in science. I'm Lee Bowman, and today we'll be catching up with Dr. Rob Harrison, who provides a fascinating insight into his research on snakebite in low-income countries, and Dr. Esther Richards, who describes the work she is doing to highlight the role of gender in defining health-related outcomes. First up is Dr. Rob Harrison, who's speaking with Chris Spencer.
Hi, I'm Chris Spencer. I'm sat here with Dr. Rob Harrison, who's head of the Alistair Reid Venom Research Unit here at the Liverpool School of Tropical Medicine. Hi there, Rob.
Afternoon, Chris.
So you recently published a paper which outlined the fact that snakebite is very much a disease of poverty. So what difficulties does this pose, and what do you view to be the best way forward?
Chris, what I'd like to do in response to that is just describe the fact that snakebite kills 95,000 people every year. And it's not only that, it also disfigures about 300,000 people every year. And these are fairly unrecognised numbers in terms of disease impact of snakebite. But equally important is the fact that snakebite has a very substantial psychological impact. So Prof Lalu here at the School of Tropical Medicine with colleagues in Sri Lanka demonstrated that the chronic psychological impact of snakebite in Sri Lanka was second only to that of the Civil War. So it's a very substantial problem that is poorly recognised. And our paper, published in PLOS NTD, demonstrated that it was the rural poor of Africa and Asia that mostly suffered from these impacts, from these disease burdens of snakebite. And that's important to understand. It is a disease of rural subsistence farmers. And these people are mostly affected by snakebite because of a number of different things. One of them is simple geographic observation, is that they mostly live several hours away from the nearest treatment centre. And so by the time they get there, the pathology of snakebite is that much worse and that much more difficult to treat. Also, because of their remoteness, they lack a political voice. And that's important because without the political voice that, for instance, our farmers have in UK or the farmers in the US, they have an enormous political voice. These rural subsistence farmers in Africa and Asia have virtually none. And so there's nothing that anyone can do to help them in these situations. But probably the greatest contributor to the neglect of snakebite is the expense of treatment, which is antivenom. So at an individual level, a course of treatment with antivenom costs about $400. Right? For people in Africa and Asia who are living on less than a dollar a day, that's unaffordable. But you now take a look at it from a regional level, from a government level. The cost of antivenom is such that the Minister of Health has a really very difficult decision to make. So, for an example, consider yourself as a Minister of Health in a small African country with a tiny budget, okay? And then you are kindly donated $1 million to spend on any therapy that you wish. So you know that a course of treatment for schistosomiasis praziquantel costs about 0.15 of a US dollar. And you also know that it costs $400 to treat a snakebite victim. So with that $1 million, you can treat 6.6 million schistosomiasis patients or 2,500 snakebite patients. It's a no-brainer. You're going to go for the treatment that's most cost-effective and the most politically effective. You're going to go for praziquantel over antivenom every time. And an example of that kind of effect that the cost of antivenom has at a regional level is one that we've been very closely involved in. And it occurred in about the late 1990s, and it was the cessation of antivenom supply to Africa because the two European manufacturers of the best antivenom for Africa decided they could no longer sustain the delivery of these antivenoms, which were losing them a lot of money. And so they stopped supplying it. So in about 1998, Professor Theakston and Professor Worrell in Oxford received a plea for help from the Nigerian Federal Ministry of Health. Please, could you help in addressing this lack of antivenom? And so we then formed the ECHITAB study group. And that was a collaboration between scientists, government people in the Ministry of Health in Nigeria, and antivenom collaborators. And that was funded by the Federal Ministry of Health. I think it was £1.92 million over 5 years, right? With those funds, we imported snakes, the most medically important snakes, from Nigeria to here, to Liverpool, extracted venom, sent that venom to five different antivenom manufacturers worldwide, so UK, Costa Rica, Egypt, Colombia, and Mexico. And all of these fairly small commercial concerns had very generously agreed to use their spare manufacturing capacity to generate experimental antivenoms to see if they could address the problem in Nigeria. And I'm delighted to say, after a lot of time spent developing these new antivenoms, preclinically testing them, and then clinically testing them in humans, that we've delivered over 37,000 vials of these antivenoms, which equates to about 17,500 life-saving treatments. So while we're very pleased, very honoured to be part of such a sort of therapy delivery project that has had such gains in terms of lives saved, we're also extremely conscious that it's not enough. It's not even enough for Nigeria, let alone the rest of West Africa. And what we need is really greater support.
So I guess it's quite lucky, we can be quite thankful that snake envenoming was relatively recently added to the WHO list of neglected tropical diseases. So to what extent, well, if any, will this recognition do to improve the global situation?
That's a terrific question, Chris. We expected, when it was announced that the WHO had put snake bite on the list of neglected tropical diseases, that this would be the springboard for change, for reversing the neglect of snake bite internationally. It hasn't happened. In fact, it's actually got a little bit worse. So an example of that deteriorating situation is that the New Horizon 2020 program in Europe for funding projects to control tropical diseases worldwide has changed its nomenclature from neglected tropical disease to neglected infectious diseases. And what that effectively has done is marginalise snakebite. It's helped all the other infectious neglected tropical diseases, but it's completely eliminated snakebite from that list. And as you quite rightly say, why isn't snakebite included in the new initiative to engage cooperatively between the NTDs to try and control all the NTDs? To us, it makes all the sense in the world to do exactly that. If you're going to try and implement the control of, for instance, of schistosomiasis, it occurs in exactly the same areas of the world as snakebite. We could do the two together, but it's not happening.
Okay, so that's the lay of the land so far. So as regards future research, I believe you were recently awarded an MRC grant, so can you go into any detail as to where, in which direction you'll take your research now?
The focus of our research has always been to try and improve the treatment of snakebite, but this grant is something that we're truly excited about. What it gives us is a real opportunity to test whether we can use the new omic technologies, proteomics, transcriptomics and so on, to make a real change in making antivenoms for the first time, which are much more clinically effective. And because they're clinically effective, you need less of it to affect cure. If you need less of it, you have fewer adverse reactions to treatment, and also it'll be affordable. And so in collaboration with Professor Calvet in Valencia in Spain and Professor Gutierrez in Costa Rica, what we're going to do, basically, is examine the immunological binding capacity of an existing antivenom, which is affordable, which is safe, but which has a fairly limited snake species efficacy. Okay, and what we're going to do is we're going to examine that reactive, the binding reactivity, and then we're going to take all the venoms from each of the most medically important snakes in Africa and look at how that base antivenom, if you like, binds to those proteins. Those proteins from snake A, for instance, that do not bind but are found to be pathogenic, we will then use, we will collect, and we'll do the same thing for venom B, venom C, venom D, and so on, through to 21 different species. And then all those proteins that from venoms A to Z that don't bind, that are pathogenic, we will then use to mix with the venoms that we used to generate the original antivenom. And in this way, we will convert an antivenom with limited efficacy to one that has pan-African efficacy. But because we're using a limited number of immunogens, this will work.
That sounds like a really fascinating project.
Well, we're delighted at the opportunity because it's never been attempted before. But while the concept, I think, is very simple, but the technology is actually quite challenging. But it does give us, for the first time, the opportunity to develop antivenoms which are extraordinarily cheap, but nevertheless have a polyspecific activity and are safe.
Well, that sounds like it's going to really have a major impact on snake envenoming in Africa. Thank you very much for the interview, and thank you for being part of the podcast.
Thank you to both Chris and Dr. Harrison for that insight into the world of snakebite research. For further information, you can visit Dr. Harrison's profile, which is available on the LSTM website. Now we go over to Kayla Barnes, who is speaking with Dr. Esther Richards.
March 8th, we saw the celebration of Women's Day. So we wanted to take some time and meet with Dr. Esther Richards from LSTM to talk to her about some of the work that LSTM does on gender equality and women's health in general. Dr. Richards' work focuses on gender aspects of health, specifically in regards to HIV and AIDS, and she'll be explaining a little bit of that work today with us. Welcome to the program.
Okay, thanks very much. Just to talk a little bit about what gender means in the context of health. Women's and men's and girls' and boys' experiences, to some extent, are very much influenced by the way that gender roles and responsibilities are allocated. Mm-hmm. And this can be driven by social and cultural expectations of what it means to be a man or a woman in any given society. So, for example, it's often the case that men will be viewed as more likely to be suitable to be truck drivers, say, whereas women might be seen as more suitable to be nurses or midwives. And this can have very particular, consequences for HIV and AIDS and for other aspects of health. So again, to look at the type of work that women and men might do, truck driving is more common for men in contexts where HIV is more, especially in contexts where HIV is in epidemic proportions. And okay. That can mean men are more vulnerable to contracting HIV because of their travel that they do. They might end up having sex with sex workers, and sex workers are more likely to be HIV positive. Mm-hmm. And by that very same token, women are more likely to be the sex workers, more likely to be vulnerable then to the transmission of HIV. And it also ties in with the status of women in general in societies that is considerably lower than men. Women may have roles that make them more vulnerable. For example, it's often younger women that might end up having sex with older men who are more likely to be HIV positive, mm-hmm. And then those younger women are more vulnerable to contracting HIV. And this can have many consequences for the transmission of HIV across the life cycle, for example, mothers transmitting to their babies.
Yes. Yeah, and so there's many aspects to HIV. It's a very complex disease, but one of the things we don't talk about a lot is who is giving the primary care to family members with HIV. And that's a little bit what your work has focused on. How do mainly women in societies care for people with HIV, and how it is a burden on the family? So what have you found when you've talked to women about this aspect of their life?
Yeah, this is a really important aspect of looking at the wider consequences of HIV/AIDS, not just at those people who are living with HIV/AIDS mm-hmm. because they have a positive status. So in the context of the work that I've been doing in collaboration with Sally Theobald, who is the head of the Gender and Health Group, and that we've been working on in collaboration with the MRC Research Unit on AIDS in Uganda,
okay,
is particularly around the neglected area of health and HIV for older carers who may be involved with working with HIV positive young people or looking after those young people in their homes and in their households. So older people haven't really been focused on very much in the context of HIV. They are both vulnerable to contracting HIV because they are still having sexual relations, for example, which is often overlooked, and mm-hmm. they're a neglected population in that sense. But they're also a neglected population in the sense that they are carers of young people who are HIV positive. And in the context of gender, that often means it's the women who are the carers. And older women are really among the most vulnerable people in any given society. So they're often very restricted in terms of their financial security, and also in terms of how they can access work and the kinds of work that they can do and how they can maintain a household that might have a number of orphans within it, or perhaps even other adults who are living with HIV and need care as mm-hmm. well.
And the financial burden that comes with that.
Exactly.
Yeah. And so this work was just recently published in the African Journal of AIDS Research. What was the title of that paper?
Yeah, that's right. We've recently had a paper published called Neglected Older Women and Men, Exploring Age and Gender as Structural Drivers of HIV Among People Aged Over 60 in Uganda.
Interesting, interesting. Yeah, it's definitely a population we don't often think about. And moving on to some of your other work, you also work both in Africa but also China on kind of different aspects of reproductive health. Can you just give us like a quick synopsis of some of those other projects that you're doing within the scope of the Gender and Health Group?
Yeah, sure. So I'm working with Angela Abassi and John Dusabe on their project called INTEC, which focuses on adolescent sexual and reproductive health. And we have been trying to develop interventions to increase uptake of services by adolescents. So they're often a population that have a lot of sexual and reproductive health needs, but they feel embarrassed and ashamed to access services. So they really need particular interventions to try to increase their mm-hmm. use of services, and also try to improve the services and make them more adolescent friendly.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And then the work in China that I've been doing has been led by Rachel Tolhurst. And we're working with a number of Chinese partners on interventions to improve post-abortion care and to increase uptake of family planning at the point of care where women have had an abortion and then they're receiving the post-abortion services that they require at that stage. So abortion is legal in China, and there's a very high burden, in fact, of women having abortions, and mm-hmm. we're trying to decrease that in the long term by providing more services for family planning and to increase uptake of contraception and family planning okay. at what is quite a critical point in their care.
Mm-hmm. And does the government provide some of the post-abortion care, or is that something that is slowly just vamping up?
So the government has been providing care, and there has been some work on this already, but there hasn't been a rollout of services that are perhaps we could call them uniform mm-hmm. across all of the health facilities that women might access for abortion. So there's been quite little energy and focus on this really important aspect of abortion services. So the abortion services themselves are very much in place and are well provided for, but it's the fact that women often have not been given enough support following abortions
yep.
to really learn about their family planning options. So
okay.
this is something we're trying to work on.
Interesting, interesting. Well, it sounds like you have a lot of very interesting projects going on. Thank you, Dr. Richards, for meeting with us. And as we've said today, gender inequality remains one of the greatest burdens, especially with access to health services. So it will be something LSTM continues to work on. And if you have any more interest in reading about Dr. Richards' work or some of the other stuff going on at LSTM, you can visit her staff profile. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you to Kayla and Dr. Richards for the interview. Coming up on the Global Health Calendar, we have World Health Day taking place on the 7th of April with a particular focus on vector-borne disease, and then a couple of weeks later, World Malaria Day, which takes place on the 25th of April. So thank you for listening. We hope you've enjoyed the interviews and will join us again for April's podcast, brought to you by the Liverpool School of Tropical Medicine.